Hey there, everybody, and welcome to Jazz United, a podcast from WBGO. This is Greg Bryant, your host of Jazz After Hours.
And I'm Nate Chenin, the editorial director at WBGO.
We like to get together to talk about generally just what's on our minds, news, issues, happenings in our music community. And we thought it best to kind of sum up the year that's been 2020. It's been a doozy.
It's almost done. The finish line is in sight, man.
Shout it out. Yeah, man. I feel you. I feel you on that. I feel you. I did want to pause, Nate, though, before we got too heavy into things and just let people know we are a listener supported station. We love doing this show. All of our programming is listener supported. So if you have not given that final Christmas gift yet, think about giving one to WBGO, will you? WBGO.org/support. You can learn about becoming a sustaining member, learn about just giving to WBGO, and you can give securely right there on the site. Just wanted to drop that for our listeners and folks.
You know, as we look back at the year that was, I think about Greg, the first time we hung out.
Yeah,
and,
man.
And this was early in the year. This was almost 11 months ago. I looked it up. It was February 4th.
Oh, man.
And you had just arrived in Newark. You had just taken this gig with WBGO, and I said, "Hey, we should meet up and hear some music." And
yeah.
And it was easier to do that than to get grab coffee because, you know, you were doing the Jazz After Hours shift. And
sure.
I said, "All right, well, let's go catch an early set before you have to, you know, man the graveyard shift at the station." So we met up, went to the Jazz Standard and heard the Robbie Coltrane Quartet.
It's really been a treat to get to know you, man, and hang with you on the reel. We've talked about that offline, but online too, I want to say it, man. It's been awesome just getting to chop it up about this music of ours. Robbie was on fire that night. His band was exceptional. And I left with the thought of, man, I just met this guy, Nate Chenin, but he's all right. We should definitely stay in touch and work on something if time and circumstances permit. And hence the birth of this show.
It's interesting. I don't know if we would have gotten to Jazz United as soon as we did,
mm-hmm.
had not, you know, everything changed. And little did we know at the time, right?
Yeah, that's right.
That there would be so much tragedy and so much just loss and stasis and mm-hmm. Disruption, including the end of the Jazz Standard. You know, what a heartbreaking piece of news that was, you know, mm-hmm. to know that that club is not coming back.
Yeah. Oh my goodness. I'm going to get us both in trouble, sort of, kind of. But if we could really just zero in for myself, you know, the way they did our music and the entertainment and the atmosphere surrounding it, if I were to have a jazz club, that's the template right there. No knock to anybody else. I love listening to jazz in other rooms in this fair city of ours, New York, in the New York area. But the Jazz Standard was special, man. Our producer, Sarah Kirsten, and I talked about it. You know, New York is not a barbecue capital. You know, it's got everything else. But man, the queue at the Standard was phenomenal. Spoken from someone who's had it in Austin and Memphis and St. Louis, it was exceptional. And the music to go along with it, there's just something about setting a tone there. High cholesterol for the body and ears that I just couldn't get enough of. And I'm so sad that we just can't do it anymore, man. They're gone.
A lot of musicians talked about this. The Jazz Standard was a place where artists always felt welcomed. Mm-hmm. You know, every member of that staff, you know, was trained by the mighty Danny Meyer Hospitality, you know, the Union Square Hospitality Group. There was just a real sense of this is a place where the artists and the audiences should feel welcome. And, you know, it's strange that that would be unusual.
Yeah.
in this realm, but you know, it was unusual. Yeah. Enough.
Yeah.
And so I know, I mean, this is a club that I feel like I came of age with the Jazz Standard. You know, I was there
right
when it opened, and I saw, I mean, I must have seen several hundred shows there.
Wow.
And, you know, I will miss it dearly, but there is some indication that Danny Meyer and Seth Abramson are thinking about coming back.
I hope so, man.
But, you know, as we, so we're doing a year in review today, and and I thought actually I would take the Jazz Standard as a springboard, because not only was that night in February our first hang and really the kind of precursor to this podcast, the Jazz Standard, it so happens that the very last gig I saw before everything shut down was in that room. It was a little bit later. It was in March, a band called Gilfema, really beautiful, beautiful gig. And that, you know, unwittingly, that was the last night I was out.
Wow.
So to conjure the spirit and get us going here, let's hear a taste of one of the songs that I heard that night from Gilfema's new album, Three. Now, the band has Lionel Lueke on guitar and vocals, Massimo Bilcati on bass, and Frank Nemeth on drums. But that night at the Standard, there was a sub. Eric Harland was playing drums. Not a bad sub.
Oh, man. Yeah.
But this is the first track from the album, and I think it might have been the first tune they played in the set. It's called Take K. That was Teke by Gilfema, a band featuring Lionel Lueke on guitar.
Yeah.
And Lionel also put out a really beautiful solo guitar album this year called HH, initials for his mentor and our hero, Herbie Hancock.
That's right. That's right.
Greg, do you remember the last gig you saw before the world stopped?
Yes. There's a vocalist by the name of Peter Collins, amazing young brother, guitarist, vocalist. I caught him at City Winery, actually. That was the last official live gig that I saw. And it was a very intimate crowd, but we could feel that something was on the horizon, that we would not be enjoying live music like that again. It was very bittersweet. 3 days later, 4 days later, something like that, the world just went on pause, and we have yet to really undo that. It's been a real adjustment coming up here with the expectation, hey, man, I'm going to be in the clubs. You know, I'm going to burn the candle at both ends, at least for the first year, get to meet people and, you know, hear this music that I've heard in my headphones and on, you know, CDs for, you know, the past 20 years, folks that are still active. But to not to be able to do that has been a real, it's just a heartbreaker, Nate. You know, I have to rely on folks like you and others who've been up here for a while to let me know how it was. But it'll come back. We just don't know when.
We talked about this. Even with the limited amount of time we had, you know, before the coronavirus pandemic officially took hold here,
right?
We both managed to catch some pretty incredible gigs.
That's true.
So I was kind of thinking, as we talk about our year in review personally for the two of us, we can actually talk about some of the best gigs we saw, and maybe we should do that and split it up pre and post lockdown.
That sounds good.
So you were alluding to it. Why don't you go first? What are, you know, maybe one or two of the standout gigs you caught in January, February, early March?
Sure, sure. There were many, but I'll identify three. One was at Smoke Jazz Club on a Tuesday night. The B3 organ is manned by a guy by the name of Mike LaDon. Well, half of his normal squad was on the road or indisposed. So the band that night was Vincent Herring on alto saxophone in place of Eric Alexander. Peter Bernstein was definitely there on guitar. But the drummer was not Joe Farnsworth. It was a man by the name of Jason Brown, a firebrand swinger. And I tell you, it was almost as if the ghost of Jimmy Smith descended upon Smoke. I don't think anyone has swung harder since I've been up here than those four guys. It was a sight to see. We were right next to the stage, and I just couldn't get enough of it. It was like, welcome to New York, Greg. That's how I felt about that gig. What about you, man?
Well, the first one that comes to mind, because I knew even as it was happening that this was going to be on my you know, best of the year. Mm-hmm. I saw the Branford Marsalis Quartet at Jazz at Lincoln Center.
Oh, yeah.
I'm looking it up. It was Friday, February 28th. Mm. Now, this band has been, you know, they've been a unit for quite some time. Mm-hmm. At this point, Justin Faulkner, who is the new kid, has already been with them for, I think, close to a decade, something like that. Mm-hmm. So this is a real, like, a real working band. And, you know, I knew it would be good. But sometimes you hear a group in the Rose Theater at Jazz and Lincoln Center, and there's a kind of decorum that descends, you know, because it is a concert hall. And man, they just blew the place up. it was fantastic. And, you know, just a real reminder of what it means to have a band that has that full commitment, you know, sort of John Coltrane quartet level commitment. Right. Branford likes to quote Elvin Jones on the subject of band cohesion. You know,
And
what Elvin used to say about that is, you got to be willing to die for a
right. That's right.
That is what every member of this band brings to the table. And I heard it that night.
Oh, man, that's great. I wish I was there. Let's keep it in that tenor vein. My one trip to the Jazz Gallery before the shutdown was to see a three tenor ensemble by the name of Ghidorah. I believe I'm saying that right. Marcus Strickland, along with Stacy Dillard and J.D. Allen. And man, I tell you, I cannot wait to see them again after this lockdown. I hope that schedules align. They were joined by Eric Wheeler on bass and Rodney Green on drums. So no piano, no guitar, just three tenors and two rhythm instruments. And they played originals, they played tunes, but just the synergy of where they come from and their attitude about the horn was very striking. And to not be an official band, but sort of a side effort, more is going to come from this. And I'm putting it in the atmosphere. We're going to see more of this.
It's crazy. It seems like so long ago, but some of my other highlights come from the Winter Jazz Fest in January. Yeah. I remember especially there was a performance by Chris Davis and the ensemble from her Diatom Ribbons project. You know, they played in Brooklyn. That was a great night, but it feels like 1,000 years ago.
Yeah. Yeah, it does.
You know, and this is the time of year where I would usually be, you know, like get my running shoes together for the next Winter Jazz Fest. Right. And so, you know, it'll be interesting to see what takes its place as we, you know, get into the early weeks of 2021. Mm-hmm. A lot of great Winter Jazz Fest stuff. I saw a really wonderful Nduduzo Makatini performance. Mm-hmm. During the festival. I know you were fresh in the city at that point, but you were circulating too.
Yes, sir. If I had to narrow it down, Nduduzo with Nasheed Waites was an early highlight. Nasheed Waites by Sea Band. That's what he called it. It was a quartet effort with Emmanuel Wilkins, my first introduction to him live, as well as Rashawn Carter, the bassist. They tore up the Zinc Bar. The Mekhi McRaven Band may have been a pinnacle experience for me at Winter Jazz Fest this year. It was my first opportunity to see Joel Ross live on vibes, as well as Brandy Younger on the harp. Junius Paul, bassist from Chicago, was the anchor for that ensemble as well. And I was transfixed, not just on the sounds, but the crowd had a very unique synergy that night, aided by not just where we were. You know, the hall wasn't a sitting hall. We were all standing. So that added even to the expectancy of the music that they were rendering. It was a really special night for me.
This is a good opportunity for us to here's some Micaiah McRaven music. This wasn't a year when he put out a new statement album of his own, but he had some overspill. You know, the album that really got a lot of attention, I think last year, it was called Universal Beings.
Right.
And this year he dropped something called Universal Beings E and F Sides. So the way that he makes these albums, I mean, he plays with different groupings of people and he just lets the tape roll. And then he kind of sculpts things into some kind of form. If we check out one of the tracks that he recorded in Ridgewood, Queens, this will give you a taste of Micaiah on drums with Brandy on harp, Brandy Younger, Joel Ross on vibraphone, Desron Douglas on bass. And so this is, you know, a close approximation of the crew that you heard.
Mm-hmm.
So why don't we check this out? This is a track called Everybody Cool.
All right. That's Micaiah McRaven on drums, and Everybody Cool was the name of that tune. What a vibe there. And Nate, I know we've seen some great things during this pandemic as well.
Against all odds, right?
Exactly right. By any means necessary in most cases. Tell me, there's some memorable stuff that you've seen up your way because, you know, the edict came down that, you know, venues couldn't advertise, they couldn't charge admission either, but the music still happened though.
I mean, I can count on one hand really the number of times that I've seen a band physically in physical space, you know, and it's hard to know how objective I'm being, but really every one of those times was special. One example I'll give, we talked about this at the time, the Falcon, which is a wonderful room up in the Hudson Valley.
Yeah,
they were doing shows outside, you know, with tables that were safely spaced and, you know, a mask mandate. And one of the gigs I saw there featured a first time convergence of John Medeski on organ, Mark Rebo on guitar, and Joe Dyson on drums.
Wow.
And it was something else, you know, it was like a little bit of that organ trio vibe, a little bit of groove exploration a la Medeski, Martin, and Wood, a little bit of sort of Albert Eiler, you know, off the deep end. I mean, it really went to a lot of places and it was fantastic.
That's awesome, man. I wish I was there. I did make one trip to Smalls about a month and a half ago to catch a McCoy Tyner tribute from the pianist David Kokoski. He's someone that I've wanted to see for several years and am just now getting the opportunity to do that live. Again, Smalls capacity is, you know, 1/4, even if that, of what it normally is. So Smalls is even smaller with the current pandemic, you know.
Yeah, what was it like? I mean, it's like 15 people. So you were one of 15 people in the room. I mean, I've been in Smalls when there were only 15 people, but you know, for different, for different reasons.
Right.
But I mean, what was the vibe? Did it feel strange, or did that feeling subside as the music took over?
That's exactly what happened. Walking down there, I felt a little odd, to be honest. I was the first one there. I sat up on the front row, and just remembering when I had been there, when it was, you know, 75 people crammed in there, you know, pre-COVID, you know, just thinking about now with a mask on, you know, there's no body at the bar. People are just trickling in, you know, what's this really going to feel like when the music gets started? But from note one, those cats went in. Jonathan Blake on drums, Joe Martin was the bass player, and David Kokoski playing the music of McCoy Tyner, who, You know, unfortunately, we lost this year, but his spirit looms, and just so thankful that those guys had it in their minds to just send out some vibes musically from or for Mr. Tyner. It was I won't forget it.
It's funny that Jonathan Blake was on that gig, because he was on another gig, you know, one of the only other gigs I saw, another one at the Falcon, a Donnie McCaslin trio.
Whoa.
with Donnie on tenor, Jonathan on drums, and Desron on bass. And that was another good one. But, you know, when you mentioned Smalls, the only time that I've been in a room with musicians since early March was an immense privilege, but I was the onstage moderator for part of the Brooklyn portion of Jazz Fest Berlin. I was in the room at Roulette, got to hear Lakeisha Benjamin with her Pursuance band, tearing it up.
Yeah.
Also the Anna Weber septet, which was fantastic. But for me, the one that really just took my head off was Craig Taborn on keyboards, Mary Halverson on guitar, and Chess Smith on drums, playing a bunch of Craig's music. Really meditative, informed by electronic music. To witness that and to feel the air moving, you know, that's something that I deeply miss. And and at that moment, I was pinching myself and saying, I better store this away somewhere, because, you know, because I'm going to need this vibe. I'm going to need this energy as we get into the still quiet months of deep winter.
Yeah. I know that feeling. It wasn't an official festival, but it was kind of a festival to me. The photographer, Jimmy Katz, put on a series in Central Park.
Yeah.
And I was privileged one Saturday to catch the Nasheed Waites trio, special trio. I don't know if these guys have ever done anything as a self-contained unit. Mark Turner was the saxophonist. My first time getting to hear Mark live, actually. Rashawn Carter was the bassist, and they just played tunes. I think there was maybe one original, but it was all tunes from the canon. Just the jubilation of being there, small crowd, outdoors, people just walking by and being mesmerized. Who are they? They're amazing. Yeah, that's Nasheed Waites. Check him out. You know, it was that type of energy. And to be tipped off by Mr. Waites, just, hey, man, you can't tell anybody this, but there's a gathering tonight in Brooklyn that you need to make sure that you're there for. I said, oh, really? The Bandwagon did a pop-up show. Nate, I've been wanting to see these guys for 20 years. I've seen them separately in different ensembles, but again, just being an uber fan of their output as a unit, it could not even prepare me for what I saw and felt that night. I was not able to go inside the building. My face was literally pressed against the brick wall. But lucky for me, the bandstand was on the other side of that brick wall. Yeah, so I heard everything. Couldn't see, but I heard and felt. And just the jubilation, again, man, talking about getting you through the winter months. Yeah. I have all I need from Taras Mateen, Nasheed, and Jason Moran.
Man, I can't remember. Maybe you can remind me. Like, there's some stories, there's some famous stories from jazz history of like a young musician who couldn't get in, but who, like, you know, like, what was it, like Charlie Parker was playing, and like somebody was like, I couldn't get in, but I could stand out in the alley and hear what was happening.
Maybe Sheila Jordan, I think, telling bird stories. Yeah,
that's great. Mm-hmm. Well, so Jason Moran and the Bandwagon, they usually play a week at the Village Vanguard during Thanksgiving week. Mm-hmm. And my guess is that under different circumstances, you would have gone to one of those nights.
I would have been there, man.
One or more. Mm-hmm. I've done that a number of times. And this year, you and I both tuned in to the live stream that the Bandwagon played from that room. I think we tuned in on successive nights. What a spirit that was, you know, and it was different. Jason acknowledged the sort of emptiness in the room and the spirits in the room. Mm-hmm. We've talked on this podcast about live streams and how much we welcome them, but also what a simulacrum they are.
You know,
there was something, you know, really beautiful about that, but also, you know, there's pain with it too,
because
you're thinking, how much longer are we going to do this?
Mm-hmm.
You know? Mm-hmm. And I guess the short answer is a little while longer still. You know, we're not in the clear yet. It's really nice that Jason and the Bandwagon got to play their gig. I also want to just note that their album, Thanksgiving at the Vanguard, which he released on Yes Records, he just put out a limited edition vinyl release of that. Mm-hmm. And I've ordered my copy. So,
oh man,
we on this show, we like to encourage people to support artists and right. to buy their stuff.
Right.
I'll throw my endorsement behind that. You know, pay for the live stream and then also buy the album if you can.
Indeed. Indeed. It's a good one. It's a good one to have. I kind of want to ask you, Nate, in no particular order, do you have 4 or 5 albums this year that really knocked your socks off, that you felt were either instant classics or just, you know, standouts, particularly for 2020?
You know, my number one album of this year is Ambrose Akin Musiri's The Tender Spot on Every Calloused Moment.
Mm.
And this is an album featuring his quartet. To me, it's just, it's such a powerful illustration of what he does as a composer and band leader and trumpeter. I think that in a way it converges some things because his band is such a force in performance. You know, they're like, you have to see them live to really know what they can do. They have a Live at the Vanguard double album that captures that
yes.
energy.
Yes, it does.
But then they're also, you know, Ambrose is also so good at putting together a studio album that feels like a work of art, taking advantage of like a concept and design. And this is the album that really converges those two strands, the kind of careful conceptual thinker that he is and the just badass on the bandstand that mm-hmm. he can be. And you know, it also speaks, as his entire career has, to the importance of Black resilience and to, you know, the energy around speaking truth to power and you know, standing up as a force of resistance. Mm-hmm. You know, it's all there. So for me, that's the number one album of the year. How about you? What stood above all the rest?
Honestly, J.D. Allen, Toys, Die Dreaming. I'm recalling something that Chuck D said in the 90s about hip hop. He said, the reason our music in Public Enemy is so hectic is because we want our lives to be light and peaceful. He was also speaking to the gangster rap movement at that time. The reason that the music is so laid back is because their lives are so hectic and laden with blues. I find myself in 2020 veering away from larger ensembles and cutting back to familiarity, not only tunes I know, but original compositions and original pairings that are smaller, concise, that get straight to the point. And mm-hmm. I think that J.D. Allen has done that with a strong dose of his conception of blues, Sonny Rollins, and freedom. I really dug this album this year, and it helped to center me. I found myself revisiting it again and again and again. So
yeah.
Props to Mr. Allen and company.
He's one of the MVP band leaders, you know, and this is a relatively young band. You know, for a long time, he had a consistent trio lineup, and he's now working with a couple of younger cats.
That's right.
But really drawing from their energy and also putting them through their paces.
Mm-hmm.
We should hear something from that album. What do you want to
Let's do that. On? It's got to be the title track. This All is right. Die Dreaming, the J.D. Allen Trio. That was J.D. Allen, Die Dreaming, the title track, if you will, to his latest recording with his new trio, Nick Cassiopo on drums and Ian Kinsliar on the bass. Sorry if I may have botched the pronunciation there. These guys are on fire, and I can't wait to see them live.
Yeah. Greg, you mentioned that you're gravitating more towards smaller groups and really concise musical statements. Mm-hmm. My second album pick flies in the face of that.
Okay.
But I'm pretty much ride or die for Maria Schneider's Data Lords.
I see.
This is a double album. Mm-hmm. I think it's quite possibly the finest album by the Maria Schneider Orchestra. I don't use this word a lot, but I think it's a masterpiece. I think it's just absolutely stunning on the level of, you know, compositional originality, orchestration. They're completely in sync with each other in a way that, you know, we talked about how the Branford Marsalis Quartet had that cohesion. Well, this is true for the Maria Schneider Orchestra, which has, I think, 18 members. You know, some of these musicians in the band have been playing Maria's music for, you know, more than two decades. You know, people like Rich Perry and Frank Kimbrough, they've been with her, you know, throughout. And they're all exceptional musicians. And she composes, you know, in a very Ellingtonian fashion. She writes with these musicians in mind. You know, she knows, okay, I'm writing for Scott Robinson right now. You know?
Yeah.
And so this is just an extraordinary achievement on the level of large ensemble, big band execution. Mm-hmm. But it's also an album that has, you know, an animating idea about our privacy and the sanctity of our internal monologues, you know, at a time of information overload, you know, and also the value of art in the streaming ecology. You know, it's such a big swing. And you cannot stream this album by design. You've got to plunk down your cash and purchase it, but I strongly urge everyone to do so. I think you will not be disappointed.
That's a great pick, Nate. I'll say another album that I'm surprised didn't get more attention was the debut album of a young trumpeter on the scene by the name of Gifton Jelen. This brand new album is called True Design. I got a chance to see Gifton in action at Smoke on a late night situation and was very impressed. People will know who pay attention that Roy Hargrove mentored this young man personally. Gifton has only been in New York maybe 3 years or so at this point. He's 21 or 22 years old, but his quintet is an incredible assembly of talent. Micah Thomas, the pianist, Philip Norris on bass, Kyle Benniford on drums, and Emmanuel Wilkin in the alto chair. This is a perfect blend of 90s swinging, burning jazz with sounds from 2020. I don't hear anybody that synthesized it quite like this. And in Gifton, you hear as wide-ranging influences as Miles Davis, Booker Little, and even Donald Eiler, Albert's brother. I've never heard that synthesis of influence either. Look out for this cat. He's saying something.
Well, he's part of a cohort, right? And I think it's cool that you're throwing him some shine. Two of the musicians you just mentioned also put out debut albums this year that did receive some attention. Micah Thomas released a trio album called Tide, and Emmanuel Wilkins released his Blue Note debut. Actually, I guess it's his overall debut, Omega. And these are musicians who, you know, like Joel Ross, they're running, you know, they're hitting the scene with just an abundance of ideas. Mm-hmm. They're deeply connected to the jazz tradition as we understand it. And they are really self-conscious about what they are bringing to the equation that is new and feels true to their experience in the world, right? It's an interesting moment to be a young, like a 20-something jazz musician, you know?
Yeah.
It's a very precarious time, but it's also a time of abundance and possibility. Mm-hmm. And I think Gifton and all of his peers, like they really show us that there's a lot to be excited about in, you know, right now and in the very near future.
That's right. That's right.
As we think about this year, and I guess mentioning Emmanuel Wilkins maybe gives us the window, although we've kind of, you know, danced around it already. This was also a year where a lot of people sort of got their coattails pulled towards, you know, really important issues around around race and social justice and injustice, you know. And, you know, I think that the election may have shifted the conversation slightly, but this was not a moment. This is truly a movement, and it preceded this year. It's going to continue on. I think musicians, jazz musicians in particular, they've reminded us how crucial and how central all of these issues are. And Greg, we devoted our very first podcast episode to this topic.
We did.
And there's been a lot of development since then, including, you know, Emmanuel's album, which includes a track called Ferguson, parentheses, An American Tradition.
Mm-hmm.
So there's been a lot of statements along those lines. And I wondered, as you look back on 2020, does that feel like a really prominent strand for you?
I think it is, Nate. I'm so glad that we got a chance to have the conversation here. The conversation will continue. I think that musicians, as I'm watching and listening, are taking more of a proactive stance. Part of the movement is about empowering each other to make our own livelihood and to make conditions better ourselves, not just waiting for the cavalry. Two efforts towards that design I'd like to point out. Bassist India Owens, her band is called The Cookout. She's also the house bass player. You may have seen her on the Colbert Show with Jonathan Batiste. She launched an initiative this summer called the Community Cookout, a spinoff of her band name, which essentially did a pop-up concert, one a month, along with feeding 100 meals to communities in need throughout the New York area. That's one initiative I think that deserves some serious shine and is indicative of, again, the self-empowerment. You know, we're not waiting on anybody to fix us. You know, we have to be our solution. To that end, I also want to mention We Insist, which is a new collective founded by J.D. Allen, who we spoke of earlier, to be a repository of information, a repository of voices, not just of music, not just of literature, but of teaching materials. Folks can go to this site and this collective to find teaching materials to help young children understand more about diversity, about education, and about living together as community. This is a musician-centered effort to do this. And I think we're going to see more of this. And even in practical traveling and touring conditions, be on the lookout for things like the circuits to open up again, but not through independent promoters, but through the insistence of musicians creating more paths to work for themselves under the conditions that they deem appropriate.
Yeah. And we're definitely going to need it.
Mm-hmm.
This scene and this circuit and infrastructure, it's not going to spring back into shape. You know,
that's right.
It's not as elastic as we might hope. It's going to need some reconstruction. And, and hopefully as we see that happen, artists and advocates will be able to reshape it in a way that is more equitable and fairer and more productive.
Yeah.
It's something worth keeping an eye out for. We also have to acknowledge that in 2020, you know, the jazz community and the musical community sustained really heavy losses.
Yes.
We don't need to linger on that here. I do want to mention that Jazz Night in America has produced its annual In Memoriam issue. I'm proud to be part of the team that worked on that. And we focus in that show on 10 of the artists we lost in 2020, real titans for us.
Yeah.
And they're 10 out of something like 50 really notable artists who left us. I wonder, Greg, was there any particular passing that really hit you personally, especially hard?
Yes, I would say McCoy Tyner and Wallace Roney. McCoy Tyner, a senior citizen in age, but you just don't expect McCoy Tyner to leave here. You know, he for many years was the sole survivor of not just John Coltrane's quartet, but of piano royalty on his own. Someone who I'd seen numerous times live, never got to meet him or speak with him personally, but McCoy seemed just one degree of separation away. And to not have him here in the physical is a bit of a mental adjustment. I would say the same for Wallace Roney, someone who I did get to interview on two occasions. Was very forthcoming with me and truthful about his legacy as an improviser and band leader, and his legacy towards many that he interacted with, his mentors, Miles Davis being one of them. But to hear his output in the last couple of years, in my opinion, be among his best recorded works, at least, to have him pass away from COVID-19 was a real surprise and shocker.
Yeah. Those are two of the artists we feature in Jazz Night, and we actually conclude the episode with Wallace and McCoy. And, you know, I'll say no more. Their legacy endures. We will continue to live with their music. Thankfully, they left us quite a bit of it. I'll urge people to check out Jazz Night, both the radio show and a special video tribute that we've produced. And, you know, Greg, you and I will continue to talk about these elders that we celebrate. You know, here's hoping that we don't see another year like this for quite some time.
I'm with you on that.
As we look back, I just want to kind of throw it out there. Were there any surprises for you in this year in any area of the music? Was there anything that just kind of caught you off guard or, you know, just threw you for a loop?
I'll say musically this, singles seem to be coming back. We've talked about this offline, but Michael Mayo, incredible vocalist, released two stellar singles, You and You and another called The Way. We've mentioned the Baylor Project, Sit On Down, that's nominated this year for Best Traditional R&B Song. And Robert Glasper, too, Better Than I Imagine, featuring the artist Her. Maybe finally we can have a market that celebrates and promotes singles. All the other genres are doing it, so why can't we?
Yeah, what is an album anymore, right? Yeah, I've been a big proponent of the EP. I think in addition to the single, the EP is a cool format, and Bandcamp has kind of made it a viable format again. Mm-hmm. You know, you don't have to sit on 60 or 70 minutes worth of music to have something ready to share with the world. Sometimes mm-hmm. it's a track or two tracks or four tracks, you know, or in some cases we've seen cool things happen where people have taken the quietude and the lack of touring during this time mm-hmm. to look back at what they've got in the vault, you know. Saxophonist and composer Tim Byrne has been, you know, just uncorking all this incredible archival stuff.
He really has.
A lot of other people have done the same, and it's cool, you know. It's like there is an audience for it, you know, and this is the time to do that. But you mentioned Michael Mayo. I love that you did. Why don't we spend a moment with one of those singles? Which one do you want to hear?
This will be Michael Mayo's tune, The Way. Something about the way. Again, this is Jazz United. It's always a ball doing these. We've had just a blast, and we look forward to 2021 with you again. Share the podcast. Let us know what you think about it. And we're going to rally and come back even stronger in 2021.
Happy holidays to everyone. We hope you stay safe and secure and have a musical time. Thank you for hanging with us. We've got a lot of good stuff coming in the new year, And if you haven't gone back in our archives, we've got almost a dozen shows under our belt at this point. Some of the things that we touched on in this episode have full episodes devoted to them, you know, in recent weeks. So please check out our show page, subscribe to Jazz United, wherever you get your podcasts. And yeah, we look forward to spending more time with you and the music in the new year.
This is Jazz United from WBGO. I'm Greg Bryant, host of Jazz After Hours. Nate Chenin is our editorial director of WBGO. Our producer is Sarah Kirsten. Our senior producer is Simon Rittner. Our theme song is United, written by Newark Zone, Wayne Shorter, performed by Newark Zone, Woody Shaw. We'll see you again real soon. Take care.